That was our nature. Early on, we called the market turbulence the kerfuffle. For Shaw, it might cause some discomfort, maybe even an embarrassing episode or two, like when a rich man's credit card is denied at a fancy restaurant. But there was a good chance we'd be okay. Hedge funds, after all, didn't make these markets. They just played in them. That meant that when the market crashed, as it would, rich opportunities would emerge from the wreckage. The game for hedge funds was not so much to ride markets up as to predict the movements within them. Down could be every bit as lucrative. To understand how hedge funds operate at the margins, picture a World Series game at Chicago's Wrigley Field. With a dramatic home run in the bottom of the ninth inning, the Cubs win their first championship since 1908, back when Teddy Roosevelt was president. The stadium explodes in celebration! But a single row of fans stay seated, quietly analyzing a slew of results. These gamblers don't hold the traditional win or lose bets. Instead, they may have bet that Yankees relievers would give up more walks than strikeouts, that the game would feature at least one bunt but no more than two, or that the Cubs starter would last at least six innings. They even hold bets that other gamblers will win or lose their own bets. These people wager on many movements associated with the game, but not as much on the game itself. In this, they behave like hedge funds. That made us feel safe, or at least safer. I remember a gala event to celebrate the architects of the system that would soon crash. The firm welcomed Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chairman, and Robert Rubin, the former Treasury Secretary and Goldman Sachs executive. Rubin had pushed for a 1999 revision of the Depression-era Glass-Steagall Act. This removed the glass wall between banking and investment operations, which facilitated the orgy of speculation over the following decade. Banks were free to originate loans, many of them fraudulent, and sell them to their customers in the form of securities. That wasn't so unusual, and could be considered a service they did for their customers. However, now that Glass-Steagall was gone, the banks could, and sometimes did, bet against the very same securities that they'd sold to customers. This created mountains of risk and endless investment potential for hedge funds. We placed our bets, after all, on market movements up or down, and those markets were frenetic. At the D.E. Shaw event, Greenspan warned us about problems in mortgage-backed securities. That memory nagged me when I realized, a couple of years later, that Rubin, who at the time worked at Citigroup, had been instrumental in collecting a massive portfolio of these exact toxic contracts, a major reason Citigroup later had to be bailed out at taxpayer expense. Sitting with these two was Rubin's protege and our part-time partner, Larry Summers. He had followed Rubin in Treasury and had gone on to serve as president of Harvard University. Summers had trouble with faculty, though. And professors had risen up against him in part because he suggested that the low numbers of women in math and the hard sciences might be due to genetic inferiority, what he called the unequal distribution of, quote, intrinsic aptitude, unquote. After Summers left the Harvard presidency, he landed at Shaw. And I remember that when it came time for our founder, David Shaw, to address the prestigious trio, he joked that Summers' move from Harvard to Shaw had been a promotion. The markets might be rumbling, but Shaw was still on top of the world. Yet, as the crisis deepened, the partners at Shaw lost a bit of their swagger. Troubled markets, after all, were entwined. For example, rumors were already circulating about the vulnerability of Lehman Brothers, which owned 20% of D.E. Shaw, and handled many of our transactions. As the markets continued to rattle and shake, the internal mood turned fretful. We could crunch numbers with the best of the best. But what if the frightening tomorrow on the horizon didn't resemble any of the yesterdays? What if it was something entirely new and different? That was a concern because mathematical models, by their nature, are based on the past and on the assumption that patterns will repeat. Before long, the equities group liquidated its holdings at substantial cost, and the hiring spree for new quants, which had brought me to the firm, ended. Although people tried to laugh off this new climate, there was a growing fear. All eyes were on securitized products, especially the mortgage-backed securities Greenspan had warned us about. For decades, mortgage securities had been the opposite of scary. They were boring financial instruments that individuals and investment funds alike used to diversify their portfolios. The idea behind them was that quantity could offset risk. Each single mortgage held potential for default. The homeowner could declare bankruptcy, meaning the bank would never be able to recover all the money it had loaned. At the other extreme, the borrower could pay back the mortgage ahead of schedule, bringing the flow of interest payments to a halt. And so in the 1980s, investment bankers started to buy thousands of mortgages and package them into securities, a kind of bond which is to say, an instrument that pays regular dividends, often at quarterly intervals. A few of the homeowners would default, of course. But most people would stay afloat and keep paying their mortgages, generating a smooth and predictable flow of revenue. In time, these bonds grew into an entire industry, a pillar of the capital markets. Experts grouped the mortgages into different classes or tranches. Some were considered rock solid, others carried more risk and higher interest rates. Investors had reason to feel confident because the credit rating agencies Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch had studied the securities and scored them for risk. They considered them sensible investments. But consider the opacity. Investors remained blind to the quality of the mortgages in the securities. Their only glimpse of what lurked inside came from analyst ratings. And these analysts collected fees from the very companies whose products they were rating. Mortgage-backed securities, needless to say, were an ideal platform for fraud. If you want a metaphor, one commonly used in this field comes from sausages. Think of the mortgages as little pieces of meat of varying quality, and think of the mortgage-backed securities as bundles of the sausage that result from throwing everything together and adding a bunch of strong spices. Of course, sausages can vary in quality, and it's hard to tell from the outside what went into them. But since they have a stamp from the USDA saying they're safe to eat, our worries are put aside. As the world later learned, mortgage companies were making rich profits during the boom by loaning money to people for homes they couldn't afford. The strategy was simply to write unsustainable mortgages, snarf up the fees, and then unload the resulting securities, the sausages, into the booming mortgage security market. In one notorious case, a strawberry picker named Alberto Ramirez, who made $14,000 a year, managed to finance a $720,000 house in Rancho Grande, California. His broker apparently told him he could refinance in a few months and later flip the house and make a tidy profit. Months later, he defaulted on the loan. In the run-up to the housing collapse, mortgage banks were not only offering unsustainable deals, but actively prospecting for victims in poor and minority neighborhoods. In a federal lawsuit, Baltimore officials charged Wells Fargo with targeting black neighborhoods for so-called ghetto loans. The bank's emerging markets unit, according to a former bank loan officer, Beth Jacobson, focused on black churches. The idea was that trusted pastors would steer their congregants towards loans. These turned out to be subprime loans carrying the highest interest rates. The bank sold these even to borrowers with rock-solid credit who should have qualified for loans with far better terms. By the time Baltimore filed the suit in 2009, more than half of the properties subject to foreclosure on Wells Fargo loans were empty, and 71% of them were in largely African-American neighborhoods. In 2012, Wells Fargo settled the suit, agreeing to pay $175 million to 30,000 victims around the country. To be clear, the subprime mortgages that piled up during the housing boom, whether held by strawberry pickers in California or struggling black congregants in Baltimore, were not WMDs. They were financial instruments, not models, and they had little to do with math. In fact, the brokers went to great lengths to ignore inconvenient numbers. But when banks started loading mortgages like Alberto Ramirez's into classes of securities and selling them, they were relying on flawed mathematical models to do it. The risk model attached to a mortgage-backed security was a WMD. The banks were aware that some of the mortgages were sure to default, but banks held on to two false assumptions, which sustained their confidence in the system. The first false assumption was that crack mathematicians in all of these companies were crunching the numbers and ever so carefully balancing the risk. The bonds were marketed as products whose risk was assessed by specialists using cutting-edge algorithms. Unfortunately, this just wasn't the case. As with so many WMDs, the math was directed against the consumer as a smokescreen. Its purpose was only to optimize short-term profits for the sellers, and those sellers trusted that they'd manage to unload the securities before they exploded. Smart people would win, and dumber people, the providers of dumb money, would wind up holding billions or trillions of unpayable IOUs. Even rigorous mathematicians, and there were a few, were working with numbers provided by people carrying out wide-scale fraud. Very few people had the expertise and the information required to know what was actually going on statistically, and most of the people who did lacked the integrity to speak up. The risk ratings on the securities were designed to be opaque and mathematically intimidating, in part so that buyers wouldn't perceive the true level of risk associated with the contracts they owned. The second false assumption was that not many people would default at the same time. This was based on the theory, soon to be disproven, that defaults were largely random and unrelated events. This led to a belief that solid mortgages would offset the losers in each tranche. The risk models were assuming that the future would be no different from the past. In order to sell these mortgage-backed bonds, the banks needed AAA ratings. For this, they looked to the three credit rating agencies. As the market expanded, rating the growing billion-dollar market in mortgage bonds turned into a big business for the agencies, bringing in lucrative fees. They grew addicted to those fees, and they understood all too clearly that if they provided anything less than AAA ratings, the banks would take their work to their competitors. So the agencies played ball. They paid more attention to customer satisfaction than to the accuracy of their models. These risk models also created their own pernicious feedback loop. The AAA ratings on defective products turned into dollars. The dollars in turn created confidence in the products and in the cheating and lying process that manufactured them. The resulting cycle of mutual back-scratching and pocket-filling was how the whole sordid business operated until it blew up. Of all the WMD qualities, the one that turned these risk models into a monstrous force of global dimension was scale. Snake oil vendors, of course, are as old as history, and in previous real estate bubbles, unwitting buyers ended up with swampland and stacks of false deeds. But this time, the power of modern computing fueled fraud at a scale unequaled in history. The damage was compounded by other vast markets that had grown up around the mortgage-backed securities, credit default swaps, and synthetic collateralized debt obligations, or CDOs. Credit default swaps were small insurance policies that transferred the risk on a bond. The swaps gave banks and hedge funds alike a sense of security, since they could supposedly use them to balance risk. But if the entities holding the insurance policies go belly up, as many did, the chain reaction blows holes through the global economy. Synthetic CDOs went one step further. They were contracts whose value depended on the performance of credit default swaps and mortgage-backed securities. They allowed financial engineers to leverage up their bets even more. The overheated and then collapsing market featured $3 trillion of subprime mortgages by 2007. And the market around it, including the credit default swaps and synthetic CDOs, which magnified the risks, was 20 times as big. No national economy could compare. Paradoxically, the supposedly powerful algorithms that created the market, the ones that analyzed the risk in tranches of debt and sorted them into securities, turned out to be useless when it came to clean up the mess and calculate what all the paper was actually worth. The math could multiply the horseshit, but it could not decipher it. This was a job for human beings. Only people could sift through the mortgages, picking out the false promises and wishful thinking, and putting real dollar values on the loans. It was a painstaking process because people, unlike WMDs, cannot scale their work exponentially, and for much of the industry, it was a low priority. During this lengthy detox, of course, the value of the debt and the homes that the debt relied on kept falling. And as the economy took a nosedive, even homeowners who could afford their mortgages when the crisis began were suddenly at risk of defaulting too. As I've mentioned, Shaw was a step or two removed from the epicenter of the market collapse. But as other players started to go under, they were frantically undoing trades that affected the ones we had on our books. It had a cascading effect. And as we entered the second half of 2008, we were losing money left and right. Over the following months, disaster finally hit the mainstream. That's when everyone finally saw the people on the other side of the algorithms. They were desperate homeowners losing their homes and millions of Americans losing their jobs. Credit card defaults leapt to record highs. The human suffering, which had been hidden from view behind numbers, spreadsheets, and risk scores, became palpable. The chatter at Shaw was nervous. After the fall of Lehman Brothers in September of 2008, people discussed the political fallout. Barack Obama looked likely to win the election in November. Would he hammer the industry with new regulations? Raise taxes on carried interest? These people weren't losing their houses or maxing out their credit cards just to stay afloat, but they found plenty to worry about just the same. The only choice was to wait it out, let the lobbyists do their work, and see if we'd be allowed to continue as usual. By 2009, it was clear that the lessons of the market collapse had brought no new direction to the world of finance and had instilled no new values. The lobbyists succeeded for the most part, and the game remained the same, to rope in dumb money. Except for a few regulations that had a few hoops to jump through, life went on. This drama pushed me quickly along in my journey of disillusionment. I was especially disappointed in the part that mathematics had played. I was forced to confront the ugly truth. People had deliberately wielded formulas to impress rather than clarify. It was the first time I had been directly confronted with this toxic concept, and it made me want to escape, to go back in time to the world of proofs and Rubik's Cubes. And so I left the hedge fund in 2009 with the conviction that I would work to fix the financial WMDs. New regulations were forcing banks to hire independent experts to analyze their risk. I went to work for one of the companies providing that analysis, Risk Metrics Group, one block north of Wall Street. Our product was a blizzard of numbers, each of them predicting the likelihood that a certain tranche of securities or commodities would go poof within the next week, the next year, or the next 5 years. When everyone is betting on everything that moves in the market, a smart read on risk is worth gold. To calculate risk, our team employed the Monte Carlo method. To picture it, just imagine spinning the roulette wheel at a casino 10,000 times, taking careful notes all the while. Using Monte Carlo, you typically start with historical market data and run through thousands of test scenarios. How would the portfolio we're studying fare on each trading day since 2010 or 2005? Would it survive the very darkest day of the crash? How likely is it that a mortal threat will arise in the next year or two? To come up with these odds, scientists run thousands upon thousands of simulations. There was plenty to complain about with this method, but it was a simple way to get some handle on your risk. My job was to act as a liaison between our risk management business and the largest and most discerning connoisseurs of risk, the quantitative hedge funds. I'd call the hedge funds, or they'd call me, and we'd discuss any questions they had about our numbers. As often as not, though, they'd notify me only when we'd made a mistake. The fact was, the hedge funds always considered themselves the smartest of the smart, and since understanding risk was fundamental to their existence, they would never rely entirely on outsiders like us. They had their own risk teams, and they bought our product mostly to look good for investors. I also answered the hotline and would sometimes find myself answering questions from clients at big banks. Eager to repair their tattered image, they wanted to be viewed as responsible, which is why they were calling in the first place. But unlike the hedge funds, they showed little interest in our analysis. The risk in their portfolios was something they almost seemed to ignore. Throughout my time at the hotline, I got the sense that the people warning about risk were viewed as party poopers, or worse, a threat to the bank's bottom line. This was true even after the cataclysmic crash of 2008, and it's not hard to understand why. If they survived that one, because they were too big to fail, why were they going to fret over risk in their portfolio now? The refusal to acknowledge risk runs deep in finance. The culture of Wall Street is defined by its traders, and risk is something they actively seek to underestimate. This is a result of the way we define a trader's prowess, namely by his Sharpe ratio, which is calculated as the profits he generates divided by the risks in his portfolio. This ratio is crucial to a trader's career, his annual bonus, his very sense of being. If you disembody those traders and consider them as a set of algorithms, those algorithms are relentlessly focused on optimizing the Sharpe ratio. Ideally, it will climb, or at least never fall too low. So if one of the risk reports on credit default swaps bumped up the risk calculation on one of a trader's key holdings, his Sharpe ratio would tumble. This could cost him hundreds of thousands of dollars when it came to calculate his year-end bonus. I soon realized that I was in the rubber stamp business. In 2011, it was time to move again, and I saw a huge growth market for mathematicians like me. In the time it took me to type two words into my resume, I was a newly proclaimed data scientist and ready to plunge into the internet economy. I landed a job at a New York startup called Intent Media. I started out building models to anticipate the behavior of visitors to various travel websites. The key question was whether someone showing up at the Expedia site was just browsing or looking to spend money. Those who weren't planning to buy were worth very little in potential revenue. So we would show them comparison ads for competing services such as Travelocity or Orbitz. If they clicked on the ad, it brought in a few pennies, which was better than nothing. However, we didn't want to feed these ads to serious shoppers. In the worst case, we'd gain a dime of ad revenue while sending potential customers to rivals, where perhaps they'd spend thousands of dollars on hotel rooms in London or Tokyo. It would take thousands of ad views to make up for even a few hundred dollars in lost fees. So it was crucial to keep these people in the house. My challenge was to design an algorithm that would distinguish window shoppers from buyers. There were a few obvious signals. Were they logged into the service? Had they bought there before? But I also scoured for other hints. What time of day was it, and what day of the year? Certain weeks are hot for buyers. The Memorial Day bump, for example, occurs in mid-spring when large numbers of people make summer plans almost in unison. My algorithm would place a higher value on shoppers during these periods since they were more likely to buy. The statistical work, as it turned out, was highly transferable from the hedge fund to e-commerce. The biggest difference was that, rather than the movement of markets, I was now predicting people's clicks. In fact, I saw all kinds of parallels between finance and big data. Both industries gobble up the same pool of talent, much of it from elite universities like MIT, Princeton, or Stanford. These new hires are ravenous for success and have been focused on external metrics like SAT scores and college admissions their entire lives. Whether in finance or tech, the message they've received is that they will be rich, that they will run the world. Their productivity indicates that they're on the right track and it translates into dollars. This leads to the fallacious conclusion that whatever they're doing to bring in more money is good. It adds value. Otherwise, why would the market reward it? In both cultures, wealth is no longer a means to get by. It becomes directly tied to personal worth. A young suburbanite with every advantage, the prep school education, the exhaustive coaching for college admissions tests, the overseas semester in Paris or Shanghai, still flatters himself that it is his skill, hard work, and prodigious problem-solving abilities that have lifted him into a world of privilege. Money vindicates all doubts, and the rest of his circle plays along, forming a mutual admiration society. They're eager to convince us all that Darwinism is at work, when it looks very much to the outside like a combination of gaming a system and dumb luck. In both of these industries, the real world, with all its messiness, sits apart. The inclination is to replace people with data trails, turning them into more effective shoppers, voters, or workers to optimize some objective. This is easy to do and to justify when success comes back as an anonymous score, and when the people affected remain every bit as abstract as the numbers dancing across the screen. I was already blogging as I worked in data science, and I was also getting more involved with the Occupy movement. More and more, I worried about the separation between technical models and real people, and about the moral repercussions of that separation. In fact, I saw the same pattern emerging that I'd witnessed in finance. A false sense of security was leading to widespread use of imperfect models, self-serving definitions of success, and growing feedback loops. Those who objected were regarded as nostalgic Luddites. I wondered what the analog to the credit crisis might be in big data. Instead of a bust, I saw a growing dystopia with inequality rising. The algorithms would make sure that those deemed losers would remain that way. A lucky minority would gain ever more control over the data economy, raking in outrageous fortunes and convincing themselves all the while that they deserved it. After a couple of years working and learning in the big data space, my journey to disillusionment was more or less complete, and the misuse of mathematics was accelerating. In spite of blogging almost daily, I could barely keep up with all the ways I was hearing of people being manipulated, controlled, and intimidated by algorithms. It started with teachers I knew struggling under the yoke of the value-added model, but it didn't end there. Truly alarmed, I quit my job to investigate the issue in earnest. Chapter 3. Arms Race. Going to College. If you sit down to dinner with friends in certain cities, San Francisco and Portland, to name two, you'll likely find that sharing plates is an impossibility. No two people can eat the same things. They're all on different diets. These range from vegan to various strains of paleo, and people swear by them, if only for a month or two. Now imagine if one of those regimes, say the caveman diet, became the national standard, if 330 million people all followed its dictates. The effects would be dramatic. For starters, a single national diet would put the agricultural economy through the ringer. Demand for the approved meats and cheeses would skyrocket, pushing prices up. Meanwhile, the diet's no-no sectors like soybeans and potatoes would go begging. Diversity would shrivel. Suffering bean farmers would turn over their fields to cows and pigs, even on land unsuited for it. The additional livestock would slurp up immense quantities of water. And needless to say, a single diet would make many of us extremely unhappy. What does a single national diet have to do with WMDs? Scale. A formula, whether it's a diet or a tax code, might be perfectly innocuous in theory. But if it grows to become a national or global standard, it creates its own distorted and dystopian economy. This is what has happened in higher education. The story starts in 1983. That was the year a struggling news magazine, U.S. News and World Report, decided to undertake an ambitious project. It would evaluate 1,800 colleges and universities throughout the United States and rank them for excellence. This would be a useful tool that, if successful, would help guide millions of young people through their first big life decision. For many, that single choice would set them on a career path and introduce them to lifelong friends, often including a spouse. What's more, a college ranking issue, editors hoped, might turn into a newsstand sensation. Perhaps for that one week, U.S. News could match its giant rivals, Time and Newsweek. But what information would feed this new ranking? In the beginning, the staff at U.S. News based its scores entirely on the results of opinion surveys it sent to university presidents. Stanford came out as the top national university, and Amherst as the best liberal arts college. While popular with readers, the ratings drove many college administrators crazy. Complaints poured into the magazine that the rankings were unfair. Many college presidents, students, and alumni insisted that they deserved a higher ranking. All the magazine had to do was look at the data. In the following years, editors at U.S. News tried to figure out what they could measure. This is how many models start out, with a series of hunches. The process is not scientific and has scant grounding in statistical analysis. In this case, it was just people wondering what matters most in education, then figuring out which of those variables they could count, and finally deciding how much weight to give each of them in the formula. In most disciplines, the analysis feeding a model would demand far more rigor. In agronomy, for example, researchers might compare the inputs, the soil, the sunshine, and fertilizer, and the outputs, which would be specific traits in the resulting crops. They could then experiment and optimize according to their objectives, whether price, taste, or nutritional value. This is not to say that agronomists cannot create WMDs. They can and do, especially when they neglect to consider long-term and wide-ranging effects of pesticides. But because their models, for the most part, are tightly focused on clear outcomes, they are ideal for scientific experimentation. The journalists at U.S. News, though, were grappling with educational excellence, a much squishier value than the cost of corn or the micrograms of protein in each kernel. They had no direct way to quantify how a four-year process affected one single student, much less tens of millions of them. They couldn't measure learning, happiness, confidence, friendships, or other aspects of a student's four-year experience. President Lyndon Johnson's ideal for higher education, quote, a way to deeper personal fulfillment, greater personal productivity, and increased personal reward, unquote, didn't fit into their model. Instead, they picked proxies that seemed to correlate with success. They looked at SAT scores, student-teacher ratios, and acceptance rates. They analyzed the percentage of incoming freshmen who made it to sophomore year and the percentage of those who graduated. They calculated the percentage of living alumni who contributed money to their alma mater, surmising that if they gave a college money, there was a good chance they appreciated the education there. Three-quarters of the ranking would be produced by an algorithm, an opinion formalized in code, that incorporated these proxies. In the other quarter, they would factor in the subjective views of college officials throughout the country. U.S. News' first data-driven ranking came out in 1988, and the results seemed sensible. However, as the ranking grew into a national standard, a vicious feedback loop materialized. The trouble was that the rankings were self-reinforcing. If a college fared badly in U.S. News, its reputation would suffer and conditions would deteriorate. Top students would avoid it, as would top professors. Alumni would howl and cut back on contributions. The ranking would tumble further. The ranking, in short, was destiny. In the past, college administrators had all sorts of ways to gauge their success, many of them anecdotal. Students raved about certain professors. Some graduates went on to illustrious careers as diplomats or entrepreneurs. Others published award-winning novels. This all led to good word of mouth, which boosted a college's reputation. But was McAllister better than Reed, or Iowa better than Illinois? It was hard to say. Colleges were like different types of music or different diets. There was room for varying opinions with good arguments on both sides. Now the vast reputational ecosystem of colleges and universities was overshadowed by a single column of numbers. If you look at this development from the perspective of a university president, it's actually quite sad. Most of these people, no doubt, cherish their own college experience. That's part of what motivated them to climb the academic ladder. Yet here they were at the summit of their careers, dedicating enormous energy toward boosting performance in 15 areas defined by a group of journalists at a second-tier news magazine. They were almost like students again, angling for good grades from a taskmaster. In fact, they were trapped by a rigid model, a WMD. If the U.S. news list had turned into a moderate success, there would be no trouble. But instead, it grew into a titan, quickly establishing itself as a national standard. It has been tying our educational system into knots ever since, establishing a rigid to-do list for college administrators and students alike. The U.S. News college ranking has great scale, inflicts widespread damage, and generates an almost endless spiral of destructive feedback loops. While it's not as opaque as many other models, it is still a bona fide WMD. Some administrators have gone to desperate lengths to drive up their rank. Baylor University paid the fee for admitted students to retake the SAT, hoping another try would boost their scores and Baylor's ranking. Elite small schools, including Bucknell University in Pennsylvania and California's Claremont McKenna, sent false data to U.S. News, inflating the SAT scores of their incoming freshmen. And Iona College in New York acknowledged in 2011 that its employees had fudged numbers about nearly everything. Test scores, acceptance and graduation rates, freshman retention, student-faculty ratio, and alumni giving. The lying paid off, at least for a while. U.S. News estimated that the false data had lifted Iona from 50th to 30th place among regional colleges in the Northeast. The great majority of college administrators looked for less egregious ways to improve their rankings. Instead of cheating, they worked hard to improve each of the metrics that went into their score. They could argue that this was the most efficient use of resources. After all, if they worked to satisfy the U.S. News algorithm, they'd raise more money, attract brighter students and professors, and keep rising on the list. Was there really any choice? Robert Morse, who has worked at the company since 1976 and heads up the college rankings, argued in interviews that the rankings pushed the colleges to set meaningful goals. If they could improve graduation rates or put students in smaller classes, that was a good thing. Education benefited from the focus. He admitted that the most relevant data, what the students had learned at each school, was inaccessible. But the U.S. News model, constructed from proxies, was the next best thing. However, when you create a model from proxies, it is far simpler for people to game it. This is because proxies are easier to manipulate than the complicated reality they represent. Here's an example. Let's say a website is looking to hire a social media maven. Many people apply for the job and they send information about the various marketing campaigns they've run, but it takes way too much time to track down and evaluate all their work. So the hiring manager settles on a proxy. She gives strong consideration to applicants with the most followers on Twitter. That's a sign of social media engagement, isn't it? Well, it's a reasonable enough proxy, but what happens when word leaks out, as it surely will, that assembling a crowd on Twitter is key for getting a job at this company? Candidates soon do everything they can to ratchet up their Twitter numbers. Some pay $19.95 for a service that populates their feed with thousands of followers, most of them generated by robots. As people game the system, the proxy loses its effectiveness. Cheaters wind up as false positives. In the case of the U.S. News rankings, everyone from prospective students to alumni to human resource departments quickly accepted the score as a measurement of educational quality. So the colleges played along. They pushed to improve in each of the areas the rankings measured. Many, in fact, were most frustrated by the 25% of the rankings they had no control over. The reputational score, which came from the questionnaires filled out by college presidents and provosts. This part of the analysis, like any collection of human opinion, was sure to include old-fashioned prejudice and ignorance. It tended to protect the famous schools at the top of the list because they were the ones people knew about, and it made it harder for up-and-comers. In 2008, Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas, was tumbling in the U.S. News ranking. Its score, which had been 97 3 years earlier, had fallen to 105, 108, and now 113. This agitated alumni and boosters and put the chancellor, Victor Boschini, in the hot seat. "The whole thing is very frustrating to me," Boschini told the campus news site TCU 360. He insisted that TCU was advancing in every indicator. Quote, "Our retention rate is improving, our fundraising, all the things they go on," unquote. There were two problems with Boschini's analysis. First, the U.S. news ranking model didn't judge the colleges in isolation. Even schools that improved their numbers would fall behind if others advanced faster. To put it in academic terms, the U.S. news model graded colleges on a curve. And that fed what amounted to a growing arms race. The other problem was the reputational score, the 25% TCU couldn't control. Raymond Brown, the dean of admissions, noted that reputation was the most heavily weighted variable, quote, "which is absurd because it is entirely subjective," unquote. Wes Wagoner, director of freshman admissions, added that colleges marketed themselves to each other to boost their reputational score. Quote, "I get stuff in the mail from other colleges trying to convince us that they're a good school," unquote, Wagoner said. Despite this grousing, TCU set out to improve the 75% of the score it could control. After all, if the university's score rose, its reputation would eventually follow. With time, its peers would note the progress and give it higher numbers. The key was to get things moving in the right direction. TCU launched a $250 million fundraising drive. It far surpassed its goal and brought in $434 million by 2009. That alone boosted TCU's ranking, since fundraising is one of the metrics. The university spent much of the money on campus improvements, including $100 million on the Central Mall and a new student union, in an effort to make TCU a more attractive destination for students. While there's nothing wrong with that, it conveniently feeds the U.S. News algorithm. The more students apply, the more selective the school can be. Perhaps more important, TCU built a state-of-the-art sports training facility and pumped resources into its football program. In the following years, TCU's football team, the Horned Frogs, became a national powerhouse. In 2010, they went undefeated, beating Wisconsin in the Rose Bowl. That success allowed TCU to benefit from what's called the Flutie effect. In 1984, in one of the most exciting college football games in history, a quarterback at Boston College, Doug Flutie, completed a long, last-second Hail Mary pass to defeat the University of Miami. Flutie became a legend. Within 2 years, applications to BC were up by 30%. The same boost occurred for Georgetown University when its basketball team, anchored by Patrick Ewing, played in 3 national championship games. Winning athletic programs, it turns out, are the most effective promotions for some applicants. To legions of athletically oriented high school seniors watching college sports on TV, schools with great teams look appealing. Students are proud to wear the school's name. They paint their faces and celebrate. Applications shoot up. With more students seeking admission, administrators can lift the bar, raising the average test scores of incoming freshmen. That helps the rating. And the more applicants the school rejects, the lower, and for the ranking better, its acceptance rate. TCU's strategy worked. By 2013, it was the second most selective university in Texas, trailing only prestigious Rice University in Houston. That same year, it registered the highest SAT and ACT scores in its history. Its rank in the U.S. News list climbed. In 2015, it finished in 76th place, a climb of 37 places in just 7 years. Despite my issues with the U.S. News model and its status as a WMD, it's important to note that this dramatic climb up the rankings may well have benefited TCU as a university. After all, most of the proxies in the U.S. News model reflect a school's overall quality to some degree, just as many dieters thrive by following the caveman regime. The problem isn't the U.S. News model, but its scale. It forces everyone to shoot for exactly the same goals, which creates a rat race and lots of harmful, unintended consequences. In the years before the rankings, for example, college-bound students could sleep a bit better knowing that they had applied to a so-called safety school, a college with lower entrance standards. If students didn't get into their top choices, including the long shots, stretch schools, and solid bets, target schools, they'd get a perfectly fine education at the safety school, and maybe transfer to one of their top choices after a year or two. The concept of a safety school is now largely extinct, thanks in great part to the U.S. News ranking. As we saw in the example of TCU, it helps in the rankings to be selective. If an admissions office is flooded with applications, it's a sign that something is going right there. It speaks to the college's reputation. And if a college can reject the vast majority of those candidates, it'll probably end up with a higher caliber of students. Like many of the proxies, this metric seems to make sense. It follows market movements. But that market can be manipulated. A traditional safety school, for example, can look at historical data and see that only a small fraction of the top applicants ended up going there. Most of them got into their target or stretch schools and didn't need what amounted to an insurance policy. With the objective of boosting its selectivity score, the safety school can now reject the excellent candidates that, according to its own algorithm, are most likely not to matriculate. This process is far from exact, and the college, despite the work of the data scientists in its admissions office, no doubt loses a certain number of top students who would have chosen to attend. Those are the ones who learn, to their dismay, that so-called safety schools are no longer a sure bet. The convoluted process does nothing for education. The college suffers, it loses the top students, the stars who enhance the experience for everyone, including the professors. In fact, the former safety school might now have to allocate some precious financial aid to enticing some of those stars to its campus. And that may mean less money for the students who need it the most. It's here that we find the greatest shortcoming of the U.S. News College ranking. The proxies the journalist chose for educational excellence make sense, after all. Their spectacular failure comes, instead, from what they chose not to count, tuition and fees. Student financing was left out of the model. This brings us to the crucial question we'll confront time and again. What is the objective of the modeler? In this case, put yourself in the place of the editors at the U.S. News in 1988. When they were building their first statistical model, how would they know when it worked? Well, it would start out with a lot more credibility if it reflected the established hierarchy. If Harvard, Stanford, Princeton, and Yale came out on top, it would seem to validate their model, replicating the informal models that they and their customers carried in their own heads. To build such a model, they simply had to look at those top universities and count what made them so special. What did they have in common, as opposed to the safety school in the next town? Well, their students had stratospheric SATs and graduated like clockwork. The alumni were rich and poured money back into the universities. By analyzing the virtues of the name brand universities, the ratings team created an elite yardstick to measure excellence. Now, if they incorporated the cost of education into the formula, strange things might happen to the results. Cheap universities could barge into the excellence hierarchy. This could create surprises and sow doubts. The public might receive the U.S. News rankings as something less than the word of God. It was much safer to start with the venerable champions on top. Of course they cost a lot, but maybe that was the price of excellence. By leaving costs out of the formula, it was as if U.S. News had handed college presidents a gilded checkbook. They had a commandment to maximize performance in 15 areas, and keeping costs low wasn't one of them. In fact, if they raised prices, they'd have more resources for addressing the areas where they were being measured. Tuition has skyrocketed ever since. Between 1985 and 2013, the cost of higher education rose by more than 500%, nearly four times the rate of inflation. To attract top students, colleges, as we saw at TCU, have gone on building booms, featuring glass-walled student centers, luxury dorms, and gyms with climbing walls and whirlpool baths. This would all be wonderful for students and might enhance their college experience, if they weren't the ones paying for it, in the form of student loans that would burden them for decades. We cannot place the blame for this trend entirely on the U.S. News rankings. Our entire society has embraced not only the idea that a college education is essential, but the idea that a degree from a highly ranked school can catapult a student into a life of power and privilege. The U.S. News WMD fed on these beliefs, fears, and neuroses. It created powerful incentives that have encouraged spending while turning a blind eye to skyrocketing tuitions and fees. As colleges position themselves to move up the U.S. News charts, they manage their student populations almost like an investment portfolio. We'll see this often in the world of data, from advertising to politics. For college administrators, each prospective student represents a series of assets, and usually a liability or two. A great athlete, for example, is an asset. But she might come with low test scores or middling class rank. Those are liabilities. She might also need financial aid, another liability. To balance the portfolio, ideally, they'd find other candidates who can pay their way and have high test scores. But those ideal candidates, after being accepted, might choose to go elsewhere. That's a risk which must be quantified. This is frighteningly complex, and an entire consulting industry has risen up to optimize recruitment. Neil Levitz, an education consulting firm, offers a predictive analytics package called Forecast Plus, which allows administrators to rank enrollment prospects by geography, gender, ethnicity, field of study, academic standing, or, quote, any other characteristic you desire, unquote. Another consultancy, Right Student, gathers and sells data to help colleges target the most promising candidates for recruitment. These include students who can pay full tuition, as well as others who might be eligible for outside scholarships. For some of these, a learning disability is a plus. All of this activity takes place within a vast ecosystem surrounding the U.S. News rankings, whose model functions as the de facto law of the land. If the editors rejigger the weightings on the model, paying less attention to SAT scores, for example, or more to graduation rates, the entire ecosystem of education must adapt. This extends from universities to consultancies, high school guidance departments, and yes, the students. Naturally, the rankings themselves are a growing franchise. The U.S. News and World Report magazine, long the company's sole business, has withered away, disappearing from print in 2010. But the rating business continues to grow, extending into medical schools, dental schools, and graduate programs in liberal arts and engineering. U.S. News even ranks high schools. As the rankings grow, so do efforts to game them. In a 2014 U.S. News ranking of global universities, the mathematics department at Saudi Arabia's King Abdulaziz University landed in 7th place, right behind Harvard. The department had been around for only 2 years, but had somehow leapfrogged ahead of several giants of mathematics, including Cambridge and MIT. At first blush, this might look like a positive development. Perhaps MIT and Cambridge were coasting on their fame while a hardworking insurgent powered its way into the elite. With a pure reputational ranking, such a turnaround would take decades, but data can bring surprises to the surface in a hurry. Algorithms, though, can also be gamed. Lior Patcher, a computational biologist at Berkeley, looked into it. He found that the Saudi university had contacted a host of mathematicians whose work was highly cited and had offered them $72,000 to serve as adjunct faculty. The deal, according to a recruiting letter Patcher posted on his blog, stipulated that the mathematicians had to work 3 weeks a year in Saudi Arabia. The university would fly them there in business class and put them up at a 5-star hotel. Conceivably, their work in Saudi Arabia added value locally. But the university also required them to change their affiliation on the Thomson Reuters Academic Citation website, a key reference for the U.S. News rankings. That meant the Saudi university could claim the publications of their new adjunct faculty as its own. And since citations were one of the algorithm's primary inputs, King Abdulaziz University soared in the rankings. Students in the Chinese city of Zhongxiang had a reputation for acing the National Standardized Test, or Gaokao, and winning places in China's top universities. They did so well, in fact, that authorities began to suspect they were cheating. Suspicions grew in 2012, according to a report in Britain's Telegraph, when provincial authorities found 99 identical copies of a single test. The next year, as students in Zhongxiang arrived to take the exam, they were dismayed to be funneled through metal detectors and forced to relinquish their mobile phones. Some surrendered tiny transmitters disguised as pencil erasers. Once inside, the students found themselves accompanied by 54 investigators from different school districts. A few of these investigators crossed the street to a hotel where they found groups positioned to communicate with the students through their transmitters. The response to this crackdown on cheating was volcanic. Some 2,000 stone-throwing protesters gathered in the street outside the school. They chanted, "We want fairness! There is no fairness if you don't let us cheat!" It sounds like a joke, but they were absolutely serious. The stakes for the students were sky high. As they saw it, they faced a chance either to pursue an elite education and a prosperous career, or to stay stuck in their provincial city, a relative backwater. And, whether or not it was the case, they had the perception that others were cheating. So preventing the students in Zhongxiang from cheating was unfair. In a system in which cheating is the norm, Following the rules amounts to a handicap. Just ask the Tour de France cyclists who were annihilated for 7 years straight by Lance Armstrong and his doping teammates. The only way to win in such a scenario is to gain an advantage and to make sure that others aren't getting a bigger one. This is the case not only in China, but also in the United States, where high school admissions officers, parents, and students find themselves caught in a frantic effort to game the system spawned by the U.S. news model. An entire industry of coaches and tutors thrives on the model's feedback loop and the anxiety it engenders. Many of them cost serious money. A 4-day application boot camp run by a company called Top Tier Admissions costs $16,000 plus room and board. During the sessions, the high school juniors develop their essays, learn how to ace their interviews, and create an activity sheet to sum up all the awards, sports, club activities, and community work that admissions officers are eager to see. $16,000 may sound like a lot of money, but much like the Chinese protesters in Zhongxiang, many American families fret that their children's future success and fulfillment hinge upon acceptance to an elite university. The most effective coaches understand the admissions models at each college so that they can figure out how a potential student might fit into their portfolios. A California-based entrepreneur, Stephen Ma, takes this market-based approach to an extreme. Ma, founder of Think Tank Learning, places the prospective students into his own model and calculates the likelihood that they'll get into their target colleges. He told Bloomberg Businessweek, for example, that an American-born senior with a 3.8 GPA, an SAT score of 2,000, and 800 hours of extracurricular activities had a 20.4% shot of getting into New York University and a 28.1% chance at the University of Southern California. Think Tank then offers guaranteed consulting packages. If that hypothetical student follows the consultancy's coaching and gets into NYU, it will cost $25,931, or $18,826 for USC. If he's rejected, it costs nothing. Each college's admissions model is derived, at least in part, from the U.S. news model, and each one is a mini WMD. These models lead students and their parents to run in frantic circles and spend obscene amounts of money. And they're opaque. This leaves most of the participants or victims in the dark. But it creates a big business for consultants like Stephen Ma, who managed to learn their secrets either by cultivating sources at the universities or by reverse engineering their algorithms. The victims, of course, are the vast majority of Americans, the poor and middle-class families who don't have the thousands of dollars to spend on courses and consultants. They miss out on precious insider knowledge. The result is an education system that favors the privileged. It tilts against needy students, locking out the great majority of them and pushing them down a path towards poverty. It deepens the social divide. But even those who claw their way into a top college lose out. If you think about it, the college admissions game, while lucrative for some, has virtually no educational value. The complex and fraught production simply resorts and re-ranks the very same pool of 18-year-old kids in newfangled ways. They don't master important skills by jumping through many more hoops or writing meticulously targeted college essays under the watchful eye of professional tutors. Others scrounge online for cut-rate versions of those tutors. All of them, from the rich to the working class, are simply being trained to fit into an enormous machine to satisfy a WMD. And at the end of the ordeal, many of them will be saddled with debt that will take decades to pay off. They're pawns in an arms race, and it's a particularly nasty one. So, is there a fix? During his second term, President Obama suggested coming up with a new college rankings model, one more in tune with national priorities and middle-class means than the U.S. News version. His secondary goal was to sap power from for-profit colleges, a money-sucking scourge that we'll discuss in the next chapter. Obama's idea would be to tie a college ranking system to a different set of metrics, including affordability, the percentage of poor and minority students, and post-graduation job placement. Like the U.S. News ranking, it would also consider graduation rate. If colleges dip below the minimums in these categories, they'd get cut off from the $180 million per year federal student loan market, which the for-profit universities have been feasting on. All of those sound like worthy goals, to be sure, but every ranking system can be gamed. And when that happens, it creates new and different feedback loops and a host of unintended consequences. It's easy to raise graduation rates, for example, by lowering standards. Many students struggle with math and science prerequisites and foreign languages. Water down those requirements and more students will graduate. But if one goal of our educational system is to produce more scientists and technologists for a global economy, how smart is that? It would also be a cinch to pump up the income numbers for graduates. All colleges would have to do is shrink their liberal arts programs and get rid of education departments and social work departments while they're at it, since teachers and social workers make less money than engineers, chemists, and computer scientists. But they're no less valuable to society. It also wouldn't be too hard to lower costs. One approach already gaining popularity is to lower the percentage of tenured faculty, replacing these expensive professors as they retire with cheaper instructors or adjuncts. For some departments at some universities, this might make sense. But there are costs. Tenured faculty working with graduate students power important research and set the standards for their departments, whereas harried adjuncts who might teach 5 courses at 3 colleges just to pay rent rarely have the time or energy to deliver more than a commodity education. Another possible approach, that of removing unnecessary administrative positions, seems all too rare. The number of, quote, graduates employed 9 months after graduation, unquote, can be gamed, too. A New York Times report in 2011 focused on law schools, which are already evaluated by their ability to position their students for careers. Say a newly minted lawyer with $150,000 in student loans is working as a barista. For some unscrupulous law schools investigated by the Times, he counted as employed. Some schools went further, hiring their own graduates for hourly temp jobs, just as the crucial 9-month period approached. Others sent out surveys to recent alumni and counted all those that didn't respond as employed. Perhaps it was just as well that the Obama administration failed to come up with a rejiggered ranking system. The pushback by college presidents was fierce. After all, they had spent decades optimizing themselves to satisfy the U.S. News WMD. A new formula based on graduation rates, class size, alumni employment, and income, and other metrics, could wreak havoc with their ranking and reputation. No doubt they also made good points about the vulnerabilities of any new model and the new feedback loops it would generate. So the government capitulated. And the result might be better. Instead of a ranking, the Education Department released loads of data on a website. The result is that students can ask their own questions about the things that matter to them, including class size, graduation rates, and the average debt held by graduating students. They don't need to know anything about statistics or the weighting of variables. The software itself, much like an online travel site, creates individual models for each person. Think of it: transparent, controlled by the user, and personal. You might call it the opposite of a WMD. Chapter 4. Propaganda Machine. Online Advertising. One day during my stint as a data scientist for the advertising startup Intent Media, a prominent venture capitalist visited the office. He seemed to be mulling an investment in the company, which was eager to put on its best face. So all of us were summoned to hear him speak. He outlined the brilliant future of targeted advertising. By contributing rivers of data, people would give advertisers the ability to learn about them in great detail. This would enable companies to target them with what they deemed valuable information, which would arrive at just the right time and place. A pizzeria, for example, might know that you're not only in the neighborhood, but also likely to be hungry for the same deep dish double cheese with pepperoni that you had last week at halftime of the Dallas Cowboys game. Their system might see that people whose data follows patterns similar to yours are more likely to click on a discount coupon during that 20-minute window. The weakest part of his argument, it seemed to me, was his justification. He argued that the coming avalanche of personalized advertising would be so useful and timely that customers would welcome it. They would beg for more. As he saw it, most people objected to advertisements because they were irrelevant to them. In the future, they wouldn't be. Presumably, folks in his exclusive demo would welcome pitches tailored to them, perhaps featuring cottages in the Bahamas, jars of hand-pressed virgin olive oil, or timeshares for private jets. And he joked that he would never have to see another ad for the University of Phoenix, a for-profit education factory that appeals largely to the striving and more easily cheated underclasses. It was strange, I thought, that he mentioned the University of Phoenix. Somehow he was seeing the ads and I wasn't, or maybe I didn't notice them. In any case, I knew quite a bit about for-profit universities, which had by that time become multimillion-dollar operations. These so-called diploma mills were often underwritten by government-financed loans, and the diplomas they awarded had scant value in the workplace. In many professions, they were no more valuable than a high school degree. While the WMD in the U.S. News Best College ranking model made life miserable for rich and middle-class students and their families, The for-profit colleges focused on the other, more vulnerable side of the population. And the internet gave them the perfect tool to do so. It's little surprise, therefore, that the industry's dramatic growth coincided with the arrival of the internet as an always-on communications platform for the masses. While spending more than $50 million on Google Ads alone, the University of Phoenix targeted poor people with the bait of upward mobility. It's come on, carried